Hello, everyone. Today, I'm joined by Alan Savory, an independent scientist, founder of Holistic Management and the Savory Institute, as well as an author with an upcoming memoir covering one of the most incredible lives one could imagine, ranging from being a game ranger, leading guerrilla units in the military, parliament, independent science, ecology, and more. It is such an enormous honor to have you here, Alan Savory. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Ben, for inviting me.
So a place I thought we could start this out is where I think most people have heard your name before, even if they didn't know it, was the TED Talk that you did about grazing and how this can be the most regenerative new thing that people aren't really thinking about as a way to bring back the land and reverse desertification we see all over the world. Tell me about this TED Talk experience for you. I can imagine that this was just a total catalyst in your life that got your message out to so many people after so many years of having relative struggle getting the message out. So what was that like, getting on that stage and sharing your message with the world?
That was thrilling. That was thanks to Chris Anderson, who owned and ran TED. They did an audition in Johannesburg. I went down to it and gave a short talk, and Chris was in the audience doing the critique. And at the end of it, he told me it was bloody terrible. And I said, thanks for being honest. I like that. And I said, give me 15 minutes and let me redo it. And I actually tore a piece of brown paper off a package because I didn't have any paper. I had a pen. I went and sat on a wall outside for 15 minutes and rewrote it, came in and regave it. And then he invited me to give a TED Talk. And I gave that, and I said to all of the people associated with me, I said, this will either bomb and go nowhere, or it'll go viral, and let's hope. And I gave that talk probably 10 times to my dog, trying to get it right. And when the talk ended, I knew that we'd got it right. So it's gone to officially over 9 million people now, or about 9 million, but unofficially to far more, because sometimes 100 people look at it together, 300, sometimes 20, 30, etc. But of course, some people repeat. But tragically, if you look at it on the TED site, it still carries a disclaimer. Because and TED never invited me to talk again. They said they had a policy of never inviting somebody twice, which is obviously not true, because they've invited two or three people to talk twice.
What does that disclaimer say? What's it warning people about?
It says that some scientists or et cetera disagree with me. I haven't been able to find a single scientist in 50 years that disagrees with me. Hundreds, thousands of academics who have no idea what my work is disagree with me. No peers. I haven't had a single peer say, what's wrong? And in developing the work, I was commissioned to put 2,000 scientists and academics through training by the U.S. government, USDA, Soil Conservation Service. And we did that over 2 years. And I deliberately spent 1 hour of every day with those 2,000 people on nothing but what I called anything goes. In other words, I said, we've got 1 hour we're devoting every day, and it is your job to find out where I'm wrong, either logically or in any science you're aware of. And in 2 years of that, with 2,000 scientists, we couldn't find any error in the logic or the science. So to say, to hear that there are people who disagree, I wish one of them somewhere in the world would come forward and tell me where.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I love about the talk that you gave, and we can get into the details of it in a second here, but it really brings together all of the different sides of the climate change debate. Because I have friends who, you know, when you look at the traditional left-right political spectrum, those two sides have very different views of climate change, obviously, as we know. But I think everyone can agree we should be making the land healthier, bringing back soil, having healthier soil for better food, cleaner water, cleaner air, happier animals. All these things should be indisputable. And it makes me think, you know, is the fact that your talk is really catering to everybody, not causing all this divisive debate? Is that why people don't like it? Because there are certain forces out there that really want to have this constant fighting between each other. Do you believe that could be a part of it?
It is, but it goes deeper than that. And you can't blame anybody. You can't blame the institutes who've opposed me bitterly, tried to get me deported from America because of the damage I'm doing to America, its powerful universities and the International Range Society, or in Southern Africa, where I was banned from setting foot on any university campus in the whole of Southern Africa for over 20 years. You actually can't blame any of those people. It took us a long time to understand it. But what I spoke about at the TED Talk was just one aspect of our work, but it was the first one that we discovered in the 1960s. And that was the whole world had always known what caused desertification. The desert sands that overwhelmed the biblical cities created the great deserts of North Africa, up into China, across into India, and the world knew what caused that. It was wherever there's damage to land, it's too many animals, if animals are involved. And that had become a scientific truth. You find it in ancient texts, blaming the shepherds for overgrazing and causing the deserts. So there are thousands of PhD dissertations based on that. Not a single one even defined overgrazing, because we knew what it was. You don't define that water flows downhill, because you know it. And it was the same with livestock. If land is deteriorating and animals are involved, there's too many animals, period. And what I discovered in 1960s was that it was wrong. So it was heresy. And so you cannot blame anybody who opposed that, etc., and still does. The people are not wrong. It's just how humans behave to new discoveries that go against the beliefs of society. So nothing's changed since Galileo and Copernicus. Nothing's changed.
And we see this happen no matter what industry or field it is. There's just this built-up belief that a lot of people have put a lot of reputational capital in. They've spent many years or decades studying these things, and they need that to be true, this idea to be true, for their identity to stay intact. And it's really painful for their identity to be shattered and to come up with a whole new idea. And it takes a really special kind of person. And you do hear these stories rarely where someone will say, you know what, my whole life's work was a lie. Let's start over. Let's figure out the truth. But it's so rare. And you know, I'm assuming that, do you believe there are still people out there that do this and are able to completely shatter their life's view and they can start over? And what do you think is the path to fostering an environment where more people are open to doing this? Because surely financial investment is a big part of it. Like we said, educational investment. How do we get it so more people can be okay with this?
Well, I would like to get that our discussion into that. And I think there's another way to do it. But to answer your question, I don't think you'll solve that problem of how to get people to accept that they were wrong, because it's so associated with the level of self-esteem. If a person's self-esteem is high, they can readily accept that they might have been wrong, torn to it. But if they've pinned their self-esteem to their status, their position in a university, their seniority, the number of papers they've written, their eminence as a scientist, they're beyond redemption. They can't. The self-esteem is too low. Now, that's beyond me to deal with that. So I don't. We've found a better way to deal with it. But before we go there, let me explain one other thing. The TED Talk was fantastic. It's got us to where we've got, I think it's 50-odd hubs in 30 countries now, where people are beginning to manage their lives holistically. So it's taken us a long way. But it's only part of our work. It was the part that I, and I'm using the word I, discovered in the 1960s and how to solve it. And that was that where we'd had this belief for thousands of years, as I said to you, we also had another belief, and that was that you could solve this problem of desertification, biodiversity loss, using the only two tools that humans have. We're a tool-using animal. Nobody listening to us can even drink milk today without using technology. If they want to, they've got to go and find a cow and suck with their mouth. You can't even drink water without technology, a mug, cup, pipe, whatever. We're a tool-using animal. And what I discovered essentially in the 1960s was that throughout a million years of human evolution, we first only had one tool, technology, and that was just stones and sticks like otters, apes, vultures, other tool-using animals, crows, etc. And then, unlike all other animals, we learned to use and then to make fire. And at that point, humans started changing whole continents, climates, etc. So we've always only had those two tools. And I realized as a young ecologist in the 60s that with those two tools, it's impossible, impossible. And I plead with any scientists in the world, any Nobel laureate, to come forward and say how it's possible to reverse global biodiversity loss and desertification. You cannot solve that biological, ecological problem with fire or technology. And so that was the first part of our work, was discovering we had no option but to use much vilified livestock. And then we had the problem, well, how the hell do you do so? Every way humans have ever managed livestock or run livestock led to biodiversity loss, and not in Costa Rica, not in London, not around Paris, but over most of the world, where there are long periods of no humidity, it led to desertification. And Elizabeth Sartoris, I loved a talk she gave once in California. She showed a picture of the Earth rotating, much like the TED picture, the NASA one I used, but hers was the Earth rotating, and you can see the vast desert areas are far greater than the forests of Amazon, far greater. And you can see this. And she had a little spacecraft up there. And she said, had we been in space observing Earth over the last 50, 100,000 years, we would have described humans as a desert-making species. So that we had to solve that problem. And the way I did it, because I tried to get the government to take over my work. I tried to get people with resources to take over my work, and I got ridiculed, basically. So I had to do it myself, and I didn't have the resources as a lone independent scientist to do extensive research, et cetera, et cetera. So I did what I could, and I looked at all professions to see if any had solved a problem, anything close to this. Looked at Harvard Business School, planning, you know, what had been done. And nobody came close to it except the army. And as I was an officer in the army in a long war, I had gone through the same Sandhurst training that we Rhodesians did, same as British Army and so on. It's similar to the training of all the armies of the world. And I looked at how they had solved found a way of planning extremely complicated situations where you didn't know what the hell was happening. It could all change overnight. In other words, how had they, over 1,000 years, refining it over the last 3 or 4 centuries, how had they learned to train officers to come up with the immediately best possible plan right now in immediate battlefield conditions, situations? And I didn't try and reinvent the wheel. So if you go to my textbook, you'll see I credit Sandhurst. They would not recognize it today, but that's where the work came from, or the technique. So we had that in the 60s. And then some things, we thought we were home and dry, or I did, and many of us did, and it spread to 5 countries that I was working in, etc. Now, something started to go wrong, and I was picking up the first signs of two clients of mine who went bankrupt. And that worried me a great deal. And of course, the planned grazing process we used was blamed. But I knew it wasn't, because I was living with the families when I was working with them. And the one, I'd seen the warning signs, and they went bankrupt because of a divorce. And I hadn't catered for a divorce. I hadn't catered for the full social consequences. We're social, cultural creatures. And the other case, I was staying with a guy, and he went into a big irrigation scheme, 3% interest, long time to pay it, blah, 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 government project. And he went into that, and I said, I think you need to be cautious. You're going to have to pump all the water onto your fields. That's going to take diesel. That's going to take energy. But I'm only advising you on your land and your grazing. So, you know, I can only say to you, have a careful look at that. Well, he didn't, and it bankrupted him. And again, the grazing got blamed. But those were red flags to me. And then, fortunately, I saw it as a disaster at the time, but like many disasters, it turned out to be a good thing. And I was driven into exile and came to the United States. And then the far-sighted bureaucrats in the USDA, who they'd been watching my work in Africa. It was already being plagiarized in Texas. And they came to me and asked if I could provide training for them. And I said, yes, I'd love to, but on one condition: we make it open to everyone, all the universities, all the government agencies, not just one. And so that was agreed. An interagency committee was put together. Don Sylvester chaired it. And that's when I put the 2,000 people through training. Now, I described that in the memoir and what came about, so I won't spend time on it now. But that's when we emerged with the second part of the problem. And that is, in many ways, no, you can't divorce them, but it's equally or more important than the fact that you cannot save the world now from desertification without livestock. The second part of it, again, went against all human beliefs. So again, tell me if I'm wrong. I would pretty well bet that every human listening to us knows that there are many ways of managing, many ways of developing policy, which is management at scale. All right, we all believe that. I believe that. I was trained that. I was taught that. Universities teach that. That's a belief. It's not true. And we discovered that when I was working with 2,000 scientists. What we discovered was, oh my God, every tool using animals uses exactly the same decision-making process, whether we're an ape, a crow, a vulture, or a human. It's genetically embedded in us. It's very simple. Tell me if I'm wrong. Haven't you made every conscious decision in your life to meet a need, a desire, or to solve a problem? So has every human. So has every human. That's the problem. It's a holistic world. It's a complex world. And that will never change. That will always be the reason for our decisions. But we are making our decisions to manage our lives. And it cannot be the context for our lives. Needs, desires, etc. So we discovered that in 1983 when I published the first edition of the textbook, that, oh my goodness, this is the cause of the problem, and we need to find why that is causing all policies of all governments to have unintended consequences when good people are developing them, highly skilled people, the world's best experts are developing them, and yet they lead to unintended consequences. Just take COVID. In the first 4 months of COVID, it did more economic damage than World War II did in 4 years. How the hell can a virus do more economic damage in 4 months than a world war in 4 years? That's not possible. So what did the damage? It's because every government developed policy to deal with it in exactly the same way. So that's the second part of our work. And I sent you that in a short talk, a 12-minute talk that I gave at COP26 when I was invited along with Vandana Shiva and I forget who the other person was. Anyway, three of us were invited to talk about how regenerative agriculture might help solve the climate change problem. And having been invited to talk about that, as you see, I refused to do so. And I said, there are people who know far more about agriculture than I'll ever know in my life. I'm just an ecologist, although I've farmed and ranched and game ranched. And I said, but I want to talk about the cause of the problem because I know nobody is doing so. Now, Ben, everybody knows if you've got a headache, you've got a problem. Deal with the cause of it. If you take aspirin, you're dealing with a symptom. And if you take aspirin and you take more aspirin, you start to get high blood pressure or whatever. So you take codeine. And the more codeine you take, but you've still got the headache because you're just masking it with these symptoms. And then you take Tylenol. And now you've got liver problems and other problems. And that just describes how we work in the world. So if we've got a problem and you find that my headache was because somebody was banging me on the head every half hour, we'll just stop that and the headache goes. It is that simple. So I think you have interviewed a number of people in some of the 600-odd regenerative agricultural organizations in the world. You've interviewed a number of them. Tell me, did any of them spend 2 minutes talking about the cause of the problem?
You know, I'd have to go back and listen again. What would you define as the clear cause that you're alluding to here?
Yeah, go back, and I guarantee you they're all talking, and it's wonderful stuff. I support it 1,000%. I'm not opposed to anything they're saying. But what they're talking about is how to produce food by farmers based on the biological sciences. Now, how we produce food is not the problem, because everything we produce, whether milk, bread, butter, cheese, wheat, cell phones, bombs, planes, cars, music, orchestras, cities, everything we produce stops if you stop producing it. You do not manage anything we produce. You don't manage it. You produce it. All right, so that's what they were talking about. And if you go to, say, COP 26, 27, 28, 29, you can go to COP 100. You'll find them in the agricultural sphere and the energy sphere, you'll find the same. You'll find people arguing for farmer production of food based on the biological, ecological science, and you'll find the mass of people arguing for corporate production of food based on chemistry and marketing of technology. And then you'll find the mass of our 9 billion people, or however many are apathetic. So they support the bulk. And that's why agriculture is the most destructive industry ever in the history of the world, more so than coal, fossil oils, mining, anything has ever been. All right, so when you ask what is the cause of it, that fortunately, and I stress through no wisdom on my part, I'm just an ordinary person, I accidentally stumbled on in my 20s. And the memoir will cover that, when I discovered that biodiversity loss, desertification, was occurring in wild areas of Africa before we even formed national parks. And I was working with one of the world's top ecologists at that time, Sir Frank Fraser Darling, and he had no answers. And I realized, oh my God, this is serious. And that changed my whole life, and led to the last 70 years of working on that problem, trying to understand it and solve it. So as I put in that short talk at COP that I sent you, I said, thankfully, while we've had no denial about desertification, we knew it was due to livestock, and I've addressed that so I won't come back to it. I said, we have had denial about climate change being caused by humans. And we've had a lot of confusion, and that denial is still going on. We're seeing it in America right now. But I said, over the last, I don't know, 5, 10 years, whatever, every sane scientist has acknowledged that humans are causing accelerating climate change. I think we can accept that now. Sure, there are a few who are saying humans have got nothing to do with it. But they are wrong, because desertification is a major part of it, and that's 100% due to humans' management, as I showed in the TED Talk. So we now know that humans are causing climate change. Now, science is logical. Science is not illogical. Science is deduction, logic, etc., knowledge. So if the world acknowledges that now, it's tragic. The media has missed it. Our universities have missed it. Our governments have missed it. They've all missed the significance of that acknowledgement. Let me explain why. If you have a problem, climate change, and you acknowledge that humans are causing it, now you have the cause. Humans are causing it. You can have 2, 3, 4, many things affecting a problem, but only one root cause. So if humans are causing it, then fossil fuels are not causing it. And livestock, methane, is not causing it. It's humans causing it. It's they're causing it by management, how they manage fossil fuels, how they manage livestock, how they manage forestry, how they manage fisheries, how they manage all resources in the world. So that's what we need to focus on. So you actually don't need to even relook through all your past talks, because I think I can guarantee none of them talked about what we manage. Now, if we don't manage food, beef, wine, cheese, forests, fisheries, whatever, if we don't manage these resources that we are producing from nature, what is it that we manage that world leaders need to focus on? And here again, unfortunately, this came as news to everybody. We only manage three things. And everybody listening to us can attest to this. You are managing your life, you and your family. And the first thing you've got to do is manage your economy. If you don't earn money, if you don't have money to buy food, clothes, men commit suicide when they can't support their families. It's very common. And only then do you manage nature to produce every single thing that sustains humanity and civilization. All the forms of food, all the forms of music, art, literature is produced from nature, goes back to nature. Okay, so we choose these three, we manage these three things. Now, if you look at the millions of things we produce, whether cell phones, bread, wine, bombs, whatever we produce, because we don't manage it, if you stop producing, it stops. And with most of it, which involves technology, if a battery run dries, it stops. If fuel runs out, it stops. And with any form of food, if you stop producing it, it stops. And you can choose to produce milk or meat, cheese or wine, cell phones or bombs, cars or planes or whatever. You can choose. Now, when it comes to the three things we manage, our families, ourselves, our cultures, and at scale, our institutions. We cannot manage at scale without an organization or institution. So we're managing that human component. And the first thing the political party, the environmental organization, the farming organization, whatever it is, has to do, or the family, is finance themselves. If they go out of money, they're out. And then whatever they are, institution or human, at whichever scale, now they are managing nature, our life, supporting environment from which we produce every single thing that makes every business, every economy, every civilization possible. And you cannot choose to manage only the humans, or only the organization, or only the economy, or only the land. You can't choose. If you do, it'll fail, because they're indivisible. And that was the second discovery when I then, and that I say we, because 2,000 of us working on that, When we did that, that's when I published the first edition of our textbook.
So one of the things I would really like to drill into here is, for those who haven't watched the talk on YouTube, the TED Talk, which I obviously recommend everyone does for the full detailed breakdown with the visuals and everything, but and I know you've spent your whole life breaking this down for people, so I can imagine how many times you've done it over the years, but for those who just want the 101 elevator pitch on what you're talking about, I know we brought up this idea of livestock grazing as being the essential piece. Could you give us that elevator pitch for the people who haven't heard this before? What is the solution to this problem of desertification and biodiversity loss we are seeing around so much of the world right now?
Well, you've got it now that it's two things. It's how humans manage resources, right? That's the number one thing. Now, if you, as I see in your background, you're in Costa Rica, you've got perennial humidity. So life goes on. Birth, growth, death, decay. Anything in that vegetation that I can see behind you, I know because of your distribution of humidity through the year, I don't care whether you're high rainfall or low rainfall, you get humidity throughout the year. I can see it from the vegetation behind you. All right, now in that, you cannot break that cycle. You can use all the fire in the world, you can use all the chemicals in the world, you can use all the machinery in the world. You try and create 1,000 hectares of bare ground where you are. You can't do it. Why? Because nature will cover it up so quickly. Now, the rainfall in London, the rainfall in Johannesburg is about the same. Around London, it's much the same as I'm saying to you. You can overgraze every damn grass. You can use all the chemicals. You can use machinery. You cannot create 1,000 hectares of bare ground. Nature will fill it up. Now, if you come to where I live in Zimbabwe, or you come to most of the world, right across North Africa, right down the Americas, from Canada to South America, if you look at right across North America, up into China, across into India, if you look at most of Australia, all right, so now I'm talking of areas far vaster than the Amazon forest. If you look there, all right, it's terribly easy to create thousands, millions of hectares of 80, 90% bare ground between the plants. You've only got to rest the land, and it'll happen because biological decay will turn to chemical oxidation, and it cannot be solved with fire or technology. That was the subject of the TED Talk, and I explained what oxidation is and what it leads to, etc. Right, so that's why, even though you might live, say, around London or in Paris or parts of Europe or in Costa Rica, we have to be very careful what we're saying when we're saying something is a solution for the world. Because the solution right where you are, if there's some badly damaged environment or in the ocean or marine areas or wetlands, if you want to restore biodiversity, you have the most powerful tool in the world. Just rest the land. Just rest the ocean. It'll recover. It'll be in changed form if you've lost thousands of species, but it'll recover. Now, if you are in these other environments that I've said, if you rest the land, it loses biodiversity. Okay, so that's a critical part. Now, When you ask me to make that very, very simple, I often just say to people, and I hope this isn't a sexist remark or anything, I'm a bit old-fashioned, but I've often said to people with a PhD in range science, I said, God damn it, if you can't understand this, go to the village and join the old ladies in tennis shoes garden club. They'll teach you. Because if you go to them and you're dealing with a piece of bare ground and you say, how could I possibly get this to cover up? They will tell you, if that's hard capped, break it, break it. And you can do it with a tool, a pick, a shovel, a machine. Or, do you know what? Cattle hooves do it. Sheep hooves do it. Camel hooves do it. Animals do it, free of charge. They'll tell you that. And if you want plants to grow on it, and you want water to soak in it, and you want water to stay on it, cover it with some litter, some dead plant material. That's all. Now, how can you do that? You can go and cut grass and come and cover it, as people do in their gardens. Or you know what? If you put animals on, they dung and urinate and trample vegetation. And they do it free of charge. It is that simple. Now, thousands of people with PhDs designed great big machines to imitate that. And there was no science behind it. There was only what I call proof by authority. I say it works, and I am professor at such and such a university. And I say it works. Now, on the basis of that, the American government, other governments, United Nations spent billions of dollars on these machines, trying to imitate animals, break the surface, lay marsh, litter, Dixon imprinter, etc. Today, those machines lie rotting, rusting. And nobody's held accountable. Nobody refers to them now. It's too embarrassing. Now, when I suggested, by the way, we could do that with animals, it was like throwing a pork chop in the synagogue.
Yeah, and this is a very interesting idea. You talked about technology, how we've always been a species that uses technology and tools to figure things out and get things done. And it makes me beg the question, where do humans really stand in this pecking order of life on Earth? Because on one hand, you could say, you know, we keep ruining everything. We, you know, we're getting too fancy with all these tools and we're creating damaging tools that are disrupting nature. But on the other hand, you could say, well, that is, we are part of nature. And it's in our nature to create these tools and use them and keep using them. And so, you know, how do you reconcile those two? I guess the question could be, where do you see humans are in the pecking order of the web of life right now? And where should we be? And where should we aspire to move toward, to be a better steward of this land?
Bear in mind, nobody's deliberately destroying the earth as we are in our own habitat. You can live longer without water and food than you can without habitat. All right. If you don't believe that, try living underwater for 5 minutes. Now, we are destroying our own habitat. Now, we're not doing that deliberately. And that was the great breakthrough in 1983. Why have more than 20 civilizations destroyed themselves through their agriculture? Why is it now a global threat? We are globally destroying civilization as we know it, when nobody intended that. Economists call it the law of unintended consequences, jokingly. Right, so that's what we discovered. So now I'm optimistic. Prior to that, it was, let me use the Wright brothers. For thousands of years, we didn't know how to fly. Who do you blame? Somebody had to be blamed. Surely to God, we can hold somebody responsible. That's what we're saying. We didn't know why humans were destroying ourselves, our own habitat. So don't hold anybody accountable. Now, after 83, when we discovered what was causing it, yes, you can start to hold institutions accountable because they resist new knowledge. Ordinary humans don't, to a certain extent. All right, so where do humans lie in this? I'm excited for the future if we will address the cause of the problem. And what is the problem? If you had to summarize it, I would say it's global biodiversity loss. And I think the whole world is now acknowledging that that's in free fall, are the words I'm hearing in write-ups. So global biodiversity loss. Now, desertification is only a symptom of that. Without biodiversity loss, desertification doesn't occur. So that's leading to the symptom of desertification, non-effective rainfall, a term I coined in the 1960s, where your rainfall starts becoming non-effective and you start getting floods and droughts, even with no change in rainfall. That then leads to mega fires, burning at altitudes and latitudes where fires never burnt before. And these three now fuel climate change, and now they're feeding on each other in a spiral that's virtually out of control. Now, that is the problem. Now, if you're going to break that cycle, if you look at the world's scientific community, how they're trying to break it at the atmospheric level of excess carbon, greenhouse gases, etc. You cannot break it at that level. You can only break it by addressing the cause. And the cause starts with biodiversity loss. And what we are calling climate change today began roughly between 50 and 100,000 years ago. We weren't using fossil fuels. That's a latecomer that helped accelerate the curve. All right, so if now I'm very hopeful, very hopeful. If we can get the world to stop focusing on how we produce energy, do we produce it from nuclear, fossil fuels, water, wind turbines? They're arguing about how to produce energy from nature. And if we can get people to stop arguing about should we produce food from farmers or corporations, biological sciences or chemicals, stop arguing about that because it's not the problem. So if we can get people to just focus on the problem, which is just how we manage humans, culture, our organizations, financing themselves, managing nature to produce everything. And when you focus on that, the problem becomes unbelievably simple to solve. So that gives me great hope. Now, why I give all the time I can to you or any other podcast is how do we get that message out to the public?
Yeah, absolutely agree. And my question to that would be, using that framework you just gave about how we need to manage things better and the current institutional model is not getting us in the right direction, I'd be curious what you believe structurally would be the better direction to go, because we have all of these government-funded institutions that seem to be not solving the problems as you're talking about. And I, coming from the Bitcoin world, we talk about this a lot, how all of these things that are really downstream from the central banking system and the money printer just don't seem to be solving the root problems. They seem to be masking things and going after symptoms, like you said, that never seem to move the needle. So what do you think would be the framework we should aspire to? Would it be more centralization of the institutions so reform becomes easier? You don't have to reform all these different organizations? Or do you think more decentralization, more people creating their own homesteads, starting their own farms and splintering it out even more just to bring it more to an individual level? What should we be looking for the future?
None of those. None of those. None of them address the cause of the problem. Okay, so let me try and explain that. It's simpler than that. You don't look for another framework for institutions, etc. Over thousands of years, we have found that beyond the human scale, that's you and I and everybody listening, managing their family, their small communities, maybe the little small family business. Beyond that, everything is done through organizations. I've got a pencil here. No human can make them virtually today. They're made by a corporation. Just a simple toothbrush. I don't know anybody who can make them these days. They're made by a corporation. Everything is done by a corporation. We have to have them. So don't try and look for another framework. We need them. Now, we'll never change the way that humans make decisions. It's been like that for a million years. It's exactly the same for every tool-using animal. Don't try and change it. So what do we need to do? We just need our institutions at which we manage at scale to acknowledge that there are institution itself is complex and we are managing the institution with the economy and with nature to produce things. And once we acknowledge that and that institutions being complex have what we call wicked problems, meaning extremely difficult to solve, once we acknowledge that, without anybody being held accountable, blamed, or anything of that sort, start uniting as humans, it becomes relatively easy to solve. Now, when institutions, the problem when you form an institution, which you have to have, so I'm not against them, when you form them, they take a life of their own. No institution has emotion. No institution basically has common sense. Institutions find it almost impossible to ever admit error, whereas ordinary humans have all of those. Okay, so it's an institution. It's a legal entity. It's not a human being. The first institution, corporation, whatever, political party that is treated as a human, we will hang it when it poisons people or kills people. How the hell do you hang a company? We don't. We reward the senior people, move them on and go on. All right, so face that reality. Don't deny it. And then come together and address what is causing the problem. And it is not a lack of goodwill. It's not bad people. There are bad people. There are people with ill will, but they're the minority. Most humans, I believe, are good, doing their best. I really believe that. All right? So when we come together and acknowledge what is causing the problem, it is not any of these things, as I say, that we're blaming. So now, what is causing it? And it is simply the way that all governments, all environmental organizations, all farming organizations, all companies develop policy. Just change the way they develop policy, and the exact same people produce a totally different result. And we've done that over and over and over again.
So I'm curious what your thoughts are on how we fix that, because I have my view, and I'm in line with who we talked before we started recording. I listened to your episode with Saifedean Ammous, the author of The Bitcoin Standard, who I'm a very big fan of in the Bitcoin world. I think him and I would be aligned on this, thinking that the reason why the policies we keep seeing come out are not what we would call good or solution seeking or root cause healing is because there is that financial beast in the background that is causing misincentives, where people in those positions are often there just to get free money for themselves and profit themselves. We look at the politicians today, they're all super rich, way more than their salary. So they're finding ways to, you know.
Can I interject you there?
Of course. Yeah.
Do you see how you're getting into blaming? You're blaming politicians, you're blaming super. Stop it. We've got to stop blaming each other. Now, when you're saying it's because of the economic component, don't repeat history. Remember that we had economies for thousands of years where the currency first was just barter and then it was cowrie shells or whatever. And it still went wrong. That's not the problem. So don't keep barking up the wrong tree. Just face the problem. Now, what is the problem? The problem is the way that the organizations develop policy. So let me try and illustrate that. And again, anybody can tell me if I'm wrong. If a political party decides to develop an agricultural policy, which is vital, okay, how does it do so? The leader of the party, if they're very progressive, whatever, doesn't matter whether it's dictatorship in one party or a multi-party state, what they do is they decide to develop it. They're meeting a need, a desire, or solving a problem. Do you see? They're using human decision-making. So now, to solve this problem of bad agriculture or this need for a better agriculture, etc., they'll pull together specialists and experts to advise the politicians, the political leader. Now, all of these specialists and experts who are pulled together, how many will be paying their own salaries? None. Virtually none. They will all represent corporations, companies, universities, environmental organizations, institutions, and these are the heads of them or the top people in them. All right, so that's good. You're bringing all the institutions and the people with the expertise together. Now, think about this for a moment. What is the first priority of the political party? It is to finance itself. If the party runs out of money, it's dead. What's its second priority? Keep support of people, etc. What's its third priority? It has to stay in power at any cost. What's its fourth priority? The interests of the citizens. All right, so the party convening this, its fourth interest is the citizens. Now, all the institutions brought with their experts to develop the policy, first point, all of them are experts in forms of production, energy, food, whatever. Are any of them experts in how to simultaneously manage the complex of humans, culture, institutions, economy, and nature? No. So we have no experts in what is required. Now, all of them coming represent institutions. Let's say there might be one person there who doesn't. Now, what's the first concern of that institution? Finance itself. What's its second concern? Support. What's its third concern? If you're lucky, if it's a corporation of maybe market dominance or whatever, if you're lucky, the third concern or the fourth concern will be citizen interests. So every party developing that policy, their third or their fourth concern is the interests of the citizens, including their own families. Now, do you see why policy is not working? So when we develop policy using the holistic framework, I can't go into it here, but we neutralize all of this without anybody feeling blamed, responsible, anything like that. I literally hate blaming anybody or condemning anybody. What I do is to condemn how institutions behave, because if we don't face that, we're doomed. Now, when I say that, let me illustrate it with an example that happened to me a while back. I was talking to two young men in my own country. They have grown up in the country. They've seen me over years struggling. And they made a statement to me. They said, Alan, you're doing something wrong. They said, we've watched all our lives. Your message is so simple, so clear, and yet we've seen you facing constant obstruction and rejection, etc. So you're clearly doing something wrong. And I said, you guys, you're all right. And I said, I've had many people tell me that over the last 60 years. I've had nobody tell me how to do it right. So we're trying to put two new heretical concepts into society. And I said, but anyway, how are you guys doing? And they said, what do you mean? We're not managing anything. And I said, how are you doing? And they said, we don't understand you. And I said, well, by the look of you, you look like Christians. Are you? And they said, yes. And I said, what did your founder have to say? Didn't he talk about love and caring? Isn't that simple? Over 2,000 years, how many millions of Christians, families, people have been capable of love and caring for each other? Millions of millions. What happened when you managed religion at scale? You formed well over 2,000 Christian churches, and you've been fighting each other, going to war. It was Christians who carried out the Holocaust. You've had major religions protecting pedophile priests. Is this what your founder said? I said, you guys aren't doing any better than I am. And I think at that point, they got it. Our institutions, we have to have them. That we have to start facing the fact that they're not human.
I'm trying to figure out what is your path to fixing those institutional problems. And I certainly want to agree that, you know, I don't mean to blame the people within them as bad people. These are just people that are following their incentives that they're given. And I try to look more at the system itself as the issue. And so from your framework that, you know, we do need these institutions, we just need to, you know, scale them differently in a more holistic way, like you said, how would you summarize the better way to do that?
No, I didn't actually say that. We can't scale them differently. We don't need them to do things in a more holistic way. You know, people thought more holistically for centuries, old cultures, Aboriginal cultures, Native American cultures. It didn't help them. It's how humans make decisions. I keep stressing that. All right, so we need our institutions. And as I said just now, If I could wave a magic wand, it'd just be to get one statesman, leader of any country, to just say, I'm going to carry on governing as I am. I'm a politician. Can't take risk. But concurrently, I'm going to have my experts, my people, our country, develop policy in the way Alan's talking about. They just get the Savory Institute to facilitate it. They won't develop the policy. They just facilitate how you manage the complexity of humans, institutions, economy, and nature to produce food or to produce energy or whatever. So that would be my wish. And then the whole world could see, oh my goodness, this is not difficult. We're all complicating it. We're all talking about the wrong issues. We're all, and I don't want to repeat everything, we're all talking about how to produce, not how to manage.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good way to transition into what your organization is doing, the Savory Institute. Just going through this website, you can see it has so much on there, it has so much information, education, online resources, podcasts, history, like all these things are so helpful for people. So how do you see the Savory Institute coming in and being part of this solution? What's your vision for it, where it is now, where it's been, and what you see in the future for it?
Well, we took a decision 15 years ago, and we felt that getting the world to accept the whole package would be a little bit complicated. So why don't we focus on the area of the world which is where the problems are the greatest. In other words, the desertifying areas, which is the grasslands, savannas, etc., because it is the droughts, floods, desertification that's leading to most of the emigration, wars, violence, changing the whole political face of Europe, etc. So why don't we focus on that? And that has been our focus for 15 years. And through that, gradually influence public opinion through successes, results, etc., until policy changes. So we've done that for 15 years with remarkable success. And we've made more progress, I believe, than I've ever known in history, where two new concepts, contrary to all human belief, are involved. So now we are facing the fact that after 15 years, we need to review that strategy and just see, are we still on the right path? And after we've done that, perhaps I could answer your question better. At the moment, I can only give you my personal view, but we haven't worked on it as a team yet. My personal view is that if we trim the rudder a little bit, we can direct that and get even faster results. So, but let's wait and see what comes out. I think what we're doing, as I said, has made great progress, but with a little trimming, we could focus more on the policy side of things and less on the management of the grasslands alone, which has sort of boxed us in as the people that are all about cattle and wildlife and grasslands. No, we're not. We're about managing people's lives holistically. And nowhere did I get that brought out better than my wife and I went to a book signing after I'd written the first, or we'd written the first edition of our textbook. And we went to Australia for a book signing. I had trained two Australians who had gone back training many, and we were met by over 300 people at this book signing from every state except Tasmania. And what I liked was the number that came up and thanked me, and I liked that, but not for saving their farm, not for improving the land. What I liked was they came and thanked me for saving their family. Because managing holistically is all about managing our lives, not about managing grasslands. You cannot manage land. It cannot be divided from the culture, the people, the economy. They're inseparable.
I love that, and I completely agree that this is so important that we reconnect back with nature using this holistic mindset in all aspects of our lives. And there's nowhere that you shouldn't be thinking holistically, long-term, work along with nature in everything that you do, 100%. And it's so awesome to see more people coming to that conclusion through all sorts of different fields. It doesn't really, even like Bitcoin, like we talked about, Bitcoin is a very different entry point than where you came from, for example, but we're still coming to the same conclusion that we really need to work with nature here. We need to stop trying to fight these natural laws we see all around us and think holistically, like you said. So what would be the main call to action for the people out there that are looking for ways to become more holistic in how they present themselves in this world and how they raise families and, you know, just go about their daily lives in a holistic way?
And, you know, you and I are representing the whole struggle right now between you and I trying to communicate as adults. And nothing, I've never found anything blocks learning except two things. I've never, ever known ignorance block learning. I've only found what we already know as adults blocks learning and our egos. All right. And you and I are both adults and we both have egos. So we're human. Now, nothing I've said indicates that we should change our thinking. You've said we should have a different mindset, we should think holistically. You said that in several different ways. Man, I never said that. I said we have to change the way we make management decisions. You see, that's a totally different thing. But you, if we, and I'm not blaming you, because you're an adult, you're relating it to what you know. Bitcoin, and so on, all right? Remember that for thousands of years, at least 100,000 years, early cultures saw their connection to nature. It's only a recent Western culture disconnect from nature. So Native American Indians, we know in latter generations, long after the early people, saw that connection, and they tried to make decisions, management decisions in the tribe, seven generations, thinking seven generations ahead. Go to Australia, the Aborigines, I mean, they've got ceremonies, everything. They're just tied to nature. Go to all the pastoral tribes, their livestock, they are part of nature. It didn't help them. The whole of Australia was being turned into a desert. By those same people knowing, believing, thinking holistically. It's not going to help us at all if people just think holistically. We have to address the cause of the problem. And that is the way humans make management decisions, period. And anything I say after that, I'm just repeating. But I cannot.
And how does one take that management to their daily routine? How do they apply this to their lives in the best way?
Oh, it's so easy. I'll give you one example. I use it often. My wife and I had a woman come from Africa. At the time, it was funded by Ford Foundation and supported by the government there. And she came as part of six Zimbabweans for 6 months training with me in New Mexico. And she stayed with my wife and I with her son. She was a single mother with a son. And so she was learning how to manage holistically, to take this back to teach people in the villages, etc. And one day she said to me, but Nan, couldn't I do this in my own life? And I said, of course you can. Let me help you. So we sat by the dining room table and I just said to her, how do you want your life to be? Because remember, she's going to make all her decisions against needs, desires, problems, and you can't do that. You have to have a holistic context for your life, to tie your life to your life-supporting environment. So I just said to her, how do you want your life to be? You're a single mother. Does anybody make your management decisions for you? No. Does anybody have veto power over the management decisions in your life? She said, no. I said, then it's you and your son. Okay, so we've got it. Now, how do you want your life to be? And I just got her to lay that out, write it on a bit of paper. If she put any action, any decision already made, no, that's out of order. You cannot have an action, a prejudice, a decision already made in the holistic context to guide your management. It is a holistic context. And so when she had done that, I said, no, you don't manage land, but everything you eat, everything you consume, everything you throw out goes back to the environment. So how would the environment have to be generally for your great-great-great-grandson and daughters to live a life like you want to? Well, we started to describe clean air, drinkable water from the rivers, blah, 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 high biodiversity, stability, productivity of land, blah, 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 generically. And then at the end of that, I said, okay, now you're employed. People employ you. How can you make them want to employ you forever? How can you make them want to come to your help at any time? How can you make your friends really support you? Can you change any of them? No, you can't. I said, okay, so how are you going to have to be? Because at the end of the day, you're judged by your behavior, not your brand, not your marketing, not your words. End of the day, every one of us is judged by our behavior. So I just said, how are you going to have to be? And I got her to describe that. And then I said, that's it. Now, just begin making your life in that context, holistic context. And about a week later, she came to me very excited and she said, hell, this works. And I said, what happened? And she said, I went with my son to the supermarket shopping, went around the aisles, loading the cart, got to the checkout counter. There were six people ahead of me, so I had to wait. And while I was waiting, I looked at my shopping list, and I suddenly thought everything was ticked off, need, desire, need, need, desire, desire, desire. And she said, oh, my goodness, I thought of the holistic context for my life and my importance of education of my son and the things that are real value to me. And she said, I sheepishly went back and put half the things on the shelf. That is managing holistically. It's not about managing land. It's about managing our lives.
And that's a great example using just the different things you're purchasing and spending your energy and money toward in your life. And one of the programs I know that you have is the Land to Market program within Savory Institute. So I'd love to hear more about this, because this is something that everyone should be looking at. How do we really connect ourselves more closely to these regenerative practices and regenerative food production methods? Could you tell me a little bit more about this Land to Market program and what it's doing, how it's helping people?
Yeah, it's what that basically is we're trying to influence the public, corporations, everything, through showing that if people manage their lives holistically and they're also managing a farm, a ranch, or whatever, that product is absolutely sound environmentally. It's not doing any cultural damage, any economic damage, environmental damage, right from the source, the producer, to the end consumer, and trying to show land to market that every link of that chain is sound to the best of our knowledge, documented, etc. That's what that is. And so it's a great idea and concept. I'm not involved in it, but as part of the organization, I know that's going on. And then we've got another one, environmental monitoring. And again, to just try and monitor and establish that the environment is actually really improving, and to document that for various end producers, consumers, etc. So, yeah, these will go on. But they're all still associated with the management of the of farming agriculture and good. But at the end of the day, as we said earlier, we still are going to have to return to addressing the cause of the problem, which is how the institutions develop policy, because we're working at these levels, but global finance, and you're part of that with your Bitcoin, etc., is driving environmental destruction. So on the farm level, let's call it, or the pastoralist level, the human level, we can only do the best we can to manage our families, our communities, and our economy and nature to produce the food we do. But we're operating in this global economy that is driving environmental destruction. So when we do holistic financial planning, which is part of the framework that we use, we actually distinguish the sources of money. So you might want to go and look at that, being interested in Bitcoin, because what we have is, when people are investing in the business, investing in the farm, producing money, whatever, we're dealing with money. And when management decisions are made, we just have some precautionary steps there to avoid addictive use of wrong forms of money, because that leads to bankruptcy and all sorts of things. And so we, without being judgmental on them, we identify three forms of money, if you like. And one is what we call a mineral dollar. That means that the source of that wealth or money is coming from a non-renewable resource. It'll run out at some time, theoretically. Okay? Not good or bad, but acknowledge the source. And then the other is a paper dollar. So the source of this is just nothing. Created, printed, Bitcoin, paper dollar, paper money. Okay, so that's the source of it. There's no substance to it except confidence. If the public lose confidence, it has no value. And you can create trillions of dollars overnight or lose them overnight. All right, so not good or bad, just acknowledge the source. And then the third is what we call a solar dollar, because without agriculture, you cannot have a choir, you cannot have an orchestra, you can't have a church, you can't have a government, you can't have an army, you can't have a university, you can't have any business in the world sustainable, you can't have any economy in the world that will ever be sustainable without agriculture. All right, so ultimately, the economy needs to be based on the photosynthetic process, food. All right, so the third form of dollars would be called a solar dollar. Now, in managing the business, the farm, whatever, we simply get people to acknowledge the source of the money. Are they borrowing it? Is it a grant? Where is it coming from? And the pattern of use. Because if you're using it once only to build infrastructure, it might be right in line with your holistic context. If you're using it, but it's going to be a repeated use, that's not so good. It might be. So you need to look at that very carefully. And then if you are using something like, say, a paper dollar, and it's addictive with compound interest, God help you. You wouldn't know that. And a study by Ohio State University, Deb Steiner and co-workers, she and her colleagues followed early adopters who came to me for learning from me in the early 1980s when I first went to America and started teaching thousands of people. And they, from California right across to Florida, averaged 300% more profit. And all they were doing was just following what we call holistic financial planning. And at that time, the time period over which that occurred, over 600,000 farm families went bankrupt, and suicide was the leading cause of death in the same markets. And people thinking of the sources of the money, managing holistically, I stress, averaged 300% more profit. We could be doing that all over the world.
Yeah, and I know this is something that the Savor Institute is very monumental in helping, is you're increasing your footprint across the world to really push those principles, or help educate on those principles, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
How would you describe the process of how these different hubs are actually helping these different geographical locations understand these things that you are saying and implement them in their communities? And people listening would probably like to know as well how they can implement it in their own communities.
Yeah, I think that varies with every hub. It's like, how long is a piece of string? So every hub is different, but what they are is local, formed by local people, managed locally, etc. And they're part of a network, hopefully helping each other, etc. Savory Institute is part of the network and, helping with the coordination of the knowledge. and the training and things like that. So each hub is different. And again, like everything, we have that under constant review, and we'll be again shortly reviewing that, I'm sure. And one of the things I'm anxious about, so I don't know what more to say than some are being more successful than others in getting the knowledge spread, getting more and more people to manage their lives holistically on farms, ranches, etc. And one of the things I'm anxious to do, and this is my personal whim, is to get hubs like this formed in the cities, because it's not about managing land, but cities are all going to fail if we do not change how agricultural policy is developed. So if we could get hubs like this, just local people deeply concerned, getting together like a book club, whatever, in the cities, and then they could have affinity with some of the rural hubs and be able to take people out and let them see the land, etc. So that's just an anxiety of mine, is to see some people. But you can't push with a piece of string. So if dozens of young people in cities said, we're concerned about the future and we want to form a city hub, I'd love it.
Yeah, I definitely see that pattern where more and more people that are living in cities and have been brought up in cities are, they're building a closer connection to why they need to think more natural and why their environment isn't everything. It's, the grocery store doesn't make the food, is a classic example. It's connected with the nature outside the city that makes the food is brought in. So they really, it helps everyone. It benefits everyone to understand how that natural process works. And I agree, that'd be an amazing way to help educate these so many people, because there's so many people in cities that are so passionate about solving these problems, but they just don't have the correct A to B path to understanding what the solution is. So that's excellent. I love it.
Yeah, I hope something happens there, because the bulk of the population in the world has now shifted to cities. The economic power has shifted to cities. The political power has all shifted to cities. And cities people, understandably, are right out of touch with nature. And nowhere do we see this more than the very sincere, genuine people who are vegans, vegetarians, because they want to be more humane, etc. The big environmental organizations that are so raised millions of dollars to stop poaching and try to save wildlife, etc. And these are all terribly sincere people forming institutions, etc. But they're flawed. They're ending up, again, unintentionally doing great harm. Tragic harm. For example, the people who believe they're being more humane by being vegan or whatever. Humane is an urban concept, a human concept. It doesn't exist in nature. That's why we call it humane, I guess. Now, so they don't want us to kill or eat meat or whatever, because they don't want to kill, and they want to let these animals live natural lives. Well, tragically, as an ecologist and game person, wildlifer, I've witnessed thousands of animals dying a natural death. And it is brutal. Brutal. If you leave any animals, including humans, to just die naturally, how does it happen? It doesn't happen humanely. We die of starvation, or we die of disease, or we die of accident. These are the sort of things we die of. And they're all brutal. And then if you look at nature, very few animals die of disease, starvation, etc. In wild, naturally functioning nature, most animals die humanely in the gentle jaws of a lion or a crocodile. A quick, humane death. And so when we stop it, and I had people in my country calling me a brutal fellow, murderer, etc., etc., and these were good environmentalists, and I had to watch in one area of my country alone while I was the researcher in charge, I had to watch over 30,000 animals die of starvation, disease, accident. It was terrible. And that was entirely produced by good people meaning well.
Yeah, the whole food conversation of the carnivores versus the vegans, and how the majority of people right now think that the most ethical diet is veganism. I agree with you, is not correct. But outside of just the death component, like the nature of the death itself, is also the ecological component and how much damage is caused to Earth and the ecology of different ecosystems when you have to scale up this vegan diet to have all these crops, those rows and rows and rows of corn that you see, and the different ways that they have to manage that land. Like you said, I would say this is probably the worst management you could possibly have is monocropping, because that is very anti-nature. So how would you elaborate on the damage to nature if we're thinking about nature here, like we've been talking about how we want to be as intertwined with nature as possible and not cause destruction? How would you compare someone like me who eats meat from cows, who, you know, walk on the land and face one bad day in their life where they are harvested, versus the vegan diet where you have these monocrop agriculture initiatives? How would you compare those two in terms of environmental destruction?
Well, one is going to destroy civilization. The other, we've got to hope. Now, you know, what you're calling the vegan diet, and if anybody in the world wants to be vegan, it's wonderful if they're doing so for spiritual reasons or health reasons that they believe in. That's every human's right, and I would never oppose it. And I wrote a blog on it, and I was helped by a very good vegan friend to write that. And so that's fine. But if they're doing it for ethical reasons or environmental reasons, then they're doing great harm. And I've just spelled that out. And the TED Talk and so on, these all spell it out. Now, if you're going to reject all animal products for whatever reason, yes, then you're back, as Monbiot, one of the writers of The Guardian, keeps preaching, and he's written a book, Regenesis, on it, in which I'm the most criticized scientist I see. If you do take that line of the world, monocultures are chaos. There's not a scientist in the world that knows how to manage a monoculture. They defy the principles of ecology. So that whole form of agriculture, chemicals, monoculture, technology, etc., corporate production, it is destroying civilization. There's no question. Just take the United States. When I went to the United States, Soil Conservation Service people were very concerned and trying to get the message over unsuccessfully to the American population. I got the data from them. And I used to ask Americans, I was training thousands of farmers and ranchers and others, and I would ask them, what is America's biggest agricultural export? And they would all name grain or beef or whatever. And I'd say, no, no, no. And it would grind to halt. And I'd say, none of you have mentioned the biggest agricultural export of America. And then they'd say, what is it? And I'd say, dead, eroding soil. And I got the figures from your own government. America was exporting far greater tonnage than all other exports together. And the Soil Conservation Service at the time was trying to get that to the public by saying it's the equivalent of a train of rail cars full of soil leaving the country every day, that a train 21 miles long, leaving the country every day. And that was 40-odd years ago. And if anything, it's probably worse today. Why? Not because people are bad. We just go back to repeating, because of the way every government develops policy.
Alan, I know we're getting close to an hour and a half here, and I want to respect your time. So I think this would be a good time to start wrapping things up and giving some good calls to action for the people out there listening, wondering how they can be a part of these solutions you're talking about and educating themselves on the root problems that you talk about as well. So where would you direct people? I know you have tons of resources through your website, your TED Talks we talked about, your book and your upcoming memoir. So you're going to have multiple books out there. Where would you direct people, like myself also? Like I'm definitely going to be listening back to this, and I want to read your books as well to do a deeper dive into these concepts you're giving me. Where would you send folks like myself who are looking to learn more about all of this?
Well, the first thing is to care enough. If you don't care enough, you won't investigate, you won't follow up. So if you care enough about the future of your young person, you should, and so on, then start getting more information, start getting involved. Now, that'll differ for everybody, wherever they are. We've talked about possibility of city-based hubs, etc. Good sources of information, go to the website, say Re-Institute. If you get the textbook, get the most up-to-date one. But even the most, any textbook, including mine, are out of date the day they're published, because knowledge is advancing all the time. So you would get the textbook, the training materials, there's all that stuff. And then also look at things like the COP26 and podcasts, because those are running ahead of the textbook. They're more up to date. And then you mentioned the book that my wife and I are writing right now. Let me mention that because I think it's going to help everybody. That's the reason I'm writing it. I've been pushed to write a memoir for years, and I refuse to do so because I see them as egotistical, and I don't want to be part of that. That's not what I'm about. But I finally agreed to write it when I could see a purpose to it. So what I want to do in that book, and let me tell you about it, is to explain that the biggest problem facing the world we've been talking about, all right, our inability to manage this complexity of humans, economy, nature. Now, how did we discover how to address that in 1983? And I want to point out in the memoir that that could never have ever been discovered by one person, me or any other person. Impossible. It could never have been discovered by any university, institution, environmental organization. Impossible. It could never have been discovered in any one country. And it could never have been discovered at any time in history. The ability to discover that from 2,000 of us that were involved in it arose from a set of circumstances in Africa that I was born into. A country that was only 12 years old when I was born, a very small population running it, a dying days of empire, dying days of colonialism, war, politics, violence, tracking was the origin of science, as according to Liebenberg, who wrote a book about that, and I believe he's correct. And I, as an ecologist, spent 20 years of my life tracking people and dangerous game. And that's all part of it. And then exile and working with many people. And out of that mixture and that time in society emerged our ability to talk as we are today.
And I know it's coming up very quick, that release. So I'm really excited for you. I'm sure that's a huge accomplishment. You're excited to get out there. A memoir is a huge piece of that, you know, life's work you're going to have to share with the world. So congratulations on that. I'm very much looking forward to getting my hands on it myself. Alan Savory, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for unloading your wisdom on us all, giving us a lot to think about and lots of questions to ask. So I'm very much looking forward to keeping in touch with your work and all that you're doing to create a better world. So I appreciate you very much, sir.
Well, Ben, I appreciate being invited. Thank you.